happy to have Peggy and see Anthony here this evening. Peggy's going to read first, and she is a writer and a teacher. Her novels include The Lawns, that she'll be reading from tonight, and Fighting Gravity, which begins with the complexities of love between an older man and a younger woman. And ultimately, it raises questions of commitment, marital and parental responsibility, and the nature of fate. She's editor of two anthologies, All That Matters, which unpacks the lives of people who are changed by cancer. It was written under her guidance, and this collection of memoirs is a resource for healthcare professionals, cancer patients, survivors, and family members. Her other anthology, Seeds of Lotus, emerged from her writing workshops with Cambodian and Vietnamese immigrants. And it illustrates, in their own words, the devastation of war and the experience of relocation and the next generation's challenge to define its own identity. Peggy runs creative writing workshops in community education settings for healing arts, in healthcare, correctional facilities, ESL programs, and immigrant support centers. She offers professional development for middle and high school teachers as well. So with that, I'd like to invite Peggy Rahm back up here to.
Thanks for having me here. I love Gloucester.
What?
Yeah, I do have enough mic. Check that out. Chairs backwards. There. I'm just going to lean on it. I was always too short for stools. All that sounded very serious. This is not a serious book. It was a book I kind of wrote for fun and then got published for fun. I think as you get older, you stop taking yourself quite so seriously, and I just wanted to rediscover kind of why I loved writing from the age of third grade on. And this is, in a way, returning to my imagination as a nine-year-old when I first started writing. So I'll just launch in. I'm just going to read one short first scene and then one other scene. There wasn't much more he could do. He'd irrigated them, he'd fertilized them, and now he kicked one. "Grow," he said. The watermelon shuddered and lay still. And something about the movement made Leonard look closer. It had seemed not to come from the impact of his boot, but from the melon itself. Then he heard a general shuffle of leaves, and he could have sworn that it had been caused by the same little movement from all the melons in the field. He glanced up, but the field was as still as it had been when he'd looked down. "Huh," Leonard said, took off his baseball cap, wiped his forehead with his forearm, and put the cap back on. The watermelons that by now should have been fully mature and ready to harvest were the size of wiffle balls and just about as light. And though Leonard Slink had been growing his luns, as he called them, and selling them for years by the honor system in a little stand built roadside in front of his house, he had to say he'd never seen anything like this. Now he squatted, inspecting the one he'd kicked, like he'd inspected any one of them a million times before, for fungus, for rot. He'd even called the seed company a week ago to see if there'd been a mix-up in their packaging or distribution, and they'd mistakenly sent him a dwarf strain. But the plant looked perfectly healthy. The leaves were broad and thick, if more turquoise in color than he'd have associated with a melon plant. And the lungs were firm and striped the usual two-tone green, and they gleamed like they'd been individually polished. But then, looking closer, he saw something he hadn't seen before. The vine that one was attached to, he could have sworn, was moving. Not like a snake or worm or anything. It was something so subtle and slight, he had to touch it to be sure. And there it was, a pulse, as strong and steady as it would have been had it come from the thump, thump, thump of a healthy human heart. So those are the lungs. And Leonard, I'm going to try to make this quick. I'm really bad at just telling a story. Leonard calls his friend John Slinka because he's kind of freaked out by this. And John is younger than Leonard. Leonard's about 60, and John's a young carpenter in town. And John goes to a science teacher in town, see if she knows what they are, but she's not going to come into the reading tonight. In any case, John, at later in the story, the Luns get larger and they fall off the vine, and they're kind of dark and gleam with an inner light. And John decides to, without Leonard's permission, take one from the field to bring to the science teacher's house. And on the way, he kind of gets zapped by the Lun, ends up lying in the road. The Luns don't particularly like to be apart. So Leonard, who feels very protective of his Luns, sees John take it, but can't catch him in time to make him stop. So he jumps in his truck, goes chasing after John, and gets stopped by the police for speeding. And the policeman's name is Mortimer Brickman. So they come upon John lying in the road, and John kind of comes to, and they take him to the hospital, and they're now in the waiting room of the hospital. I'm getting better. That was faster. So this is the waiting room scene between John and Leonard mainly. Leonard and John were sitting next to each other on the turquoise naugahyde seats of the hospital's otherwise deserted emergency room. Leonard spoke, looking straight ahead and out the side of his mouth in the manner of spies and criminals exchanging sensitive information in train stations and airport lounges. The only thing he was missing was a newspaper in his hand, so he reached over an empty seat to the side table piled with magazines so old they felt mushy and grabbed Good Housekeeping off the top. "Yeah, you could use that, Slinkit," said Bigby, glancing down at the cover page. "Couple of dessert recipes for all those summer barbecues you have. A tell-all interview with who is it this month?" he said, leaning closer and becoming genuinely interested. "You haven't answered my question," said Slinkit, snatching the magazine out of John's line of vision and keeping his eye on the wrinkled back of Brickman's khaki uniform, making sure Brickman's attention was squarely on the nurse at the desk and the papers he was so kindly filling out on Bigby's behalf. "I saw you go raiding my field, Bigby." "I didn't go raiding, Leonard. I just took one for Lydia, you know, the science teacher. But turned out she didn't want it." "Yeah, how come?" Leonard said, and forgetting his cover, turned to look directly at Bigby. Then he glanced at Brickman, then down, and opened up the magazine to a large advertisement for Betty Crocker cake mix, which mixed a hell of a good-looking chocolate layer cake, if photos didn't lie. "Too dangerous, she said," said Bigby. "Didn't want it in her house." "Well, the woman's got good sense, unlike some lunkheads around here." "Yeah, well," John yawned, leaned back, bumped his head on the wall, and said, "Ow." "So? So what?" said John. "Where is it, John?" Slinkit said, the impatience rising in his voice even while he still managed to keep the volume low. "Bigby," Brickman said, suddenly turning around and making both men jump a little. "You gotta sign this. Can you sign this?" he said, walking over and holding out a brown clipboard with a pink form on it. "Address too, any known allergies, you know the deal." And he stood there, belly eye level with Slinkit, while John took pen in hand and went to work. "Finding that a good read, are you, Leonard?" Brickman said. "You got anything better?" Leonard said. "Actually, look at this cake, Brickman," he said, and turned the magazine so Brickman could examine it right side up. "Now, wouldn't you like a slice of that right now? A big glass of cold milk? Mm-mm, don't you know it. You know my wife. She makes a mean, like one of those chocolate mud cakes or pies, whatever you call it. It has ice cream, chocolate syrup. Thing can't stay in the freezer for more than a day with me around." And then Slinkit described the lemon icebox cake his mother used to make, and then a marble cheesecake he'd once had down at the Double Knot Steakhouse, and then Brickman named a few more restaurants in the area with the dessert menus that, in his opinion, topped the quality of the entrees, until Bigby finally said, "Here," and handed him the clipboard, which abruptly cut short a conversation that, given one more minute, was sure to have driven him right out of his mind. Only after Brickman, I returned to the reception desk and appeared to be safely out of earshot, did Bigby say, "On the side of Warner Baker Road." "What? What do you mean? How'd it get there?" said Leonard. "Long story, but that's where it is. You know, where you found me, right there. That's where the thing kind of walloped me like a weird electric light, shock, flash. I'm telling you, Slinkit, I don't want to go near one of those things again. They're lethal, scary, looking all innocent and everything like an overgrown jelly bean. but you don't know what the hell they're going to do next. Keep your voice down, said Leonard, eyeing Brickman. Of course you don't, especially if you steal them. They don't like to be separated. Let me tell you, might be one whole organism for all we know. Oh, now you're going to get all scientific on us now. Listen, Bigby, I'm in charge of them, okay? I grew them and they're mine, and I say what does and doesn't get done with them. And one thing I'm not going to allow is for anyone like you to go pilfering my field. Bigby leaned forward to get a more straight-on look at Leonard's face and said, you're really serious. He smiled. You're not joking. No, I'm not, said Slinkett, looking up long enough to glare at John, and then he looked down and turned a page so hard in the Mealy magazine he held that he almost ripped it out. Huh, said John. I haven't seen you so worked up about anything since they were thinking of building that assisted living place off Clover's Marsh out on Route 129. Yeah, well, they didn't need to go mucking up that nice tract of land there, just like I don't need you to go messing around on mine. What are you boys fighting about? Said Brickman, who had turned around to lean on the counter like he'd been listening in for quite some time, and this was how he'd made himself comfortable. None of your concern, Brickman, as it has nothing to do with food or the law, said Slinkett. Yeah, well, we'll see about that. At which point, the desk nurse called John Bigby's name and led him out of the waiting area to be examined perfunctorily by a young woman doctor who looked like she'd been wondering for some time what had ever possessed her to go into the field of medicine. And in her haste to be done, she did not see the shiny redness at the tips of Bigby's fingers that had felt hot and tingly all night. The three middle ones on each hand where he had touched the lung just before it zapped him into temporary oblivion. As soon as her gaze had drifted anywhere near that part of his anatomy, he curled his fingers into loose fists so as to avoid her discovering this little anomaly and forcing him to explain its origin. And so his tongue inspected, his pupils behaving on cue, and his blood pressure better than good, he was summarily dismissed. Only to end up sitting in yet another chair next to Slinkett, but this time a paint-spotted folding one in the cramped and filthy-floored waiting room of Hardwick's Body and Toe, which for both men was far preferable to any hospital emergency room. But no way was Leonard going to leave the Lun out there in the roadside any longer than it had been there already. And so it was Bigby's job, despite his protests, to lead him to it. However, the small kink in the plan was that Bigby had no idea where it was, there having been no real landmark out among the farm fields, no tree, no house that he paid much attention to in his previous and failed attempt to retrieve it. So he just kind of guessed. And unbeknownst to him, of course, he was off by half a mile. Leonard, let's do this in the morning, he said after the two of them had tromped around for a while, Leonard in charge of the one flashlight between them and John straggling behind like a cranky child. I'm telling you, I don't want to tangle with one of those things tonight again, Leonard. Know what I mean? I need to get some shut-eye. I mean, it's almost 2 a.m. Leonard didn't answer. He just walked away, still looking, leaving John to stand there in the dark. Leonard, I'm going home. We'll find it in the morning. I'm not even sure this is the right place. Morning might be too late. For what, Leonard? Too late for what? It just might be. That's all I'm saying, Leonard said. He had stopped to look at John and knew he'd sounded more mysterious than he'd intended, but he decided not to alter the impression. In truth, he didn't know what he'd be too late for. He just felt like he only had so much time, and yet what was he doing now but wasting it? Mostly, though, what he couldn't bear was the thought of having to give up and go home without it. Look, I'm sorry, said John. All right, I'm sorry I took it, and I'm sorry I threw the thing out on the road, but Leonard, it was acting, well, let's just say I had to. But Leonard only continued to follow John's feeble flashlight beam, stumbling in the uneven underbrush and feeling the rising frustration, the hopelessness, the inconsolable worry as the futility of his search became clear. Tomorrow, Leonard, I'm going home. We'll find it tomorrow, said Bigby. And because Leonard still didn't answer him and showed no sign of giving up, all Bigby could do was tell him he was tired and hungry and say again that he was going home. You can keep the flashlight, he said. I'll be by around 9. Told Lydia I'd meet her out at your place then, remember? Leonard still gave no sign that anyone at all had spoken to him, or that he was nothing but alone out there, seeking something he knew in his heart he was nowhere near. Thanks. Thank you.
C. Anthony Martinetti is our next reader, and about a year ago, one of our volunteers came and said, "Oh, there's this great writer in Boston. You guys should really bring him up here." And that was Mimi Spencer. And we finally brought him up here, and she had to go on a trip and take her mother to California, so she's not here to introduce him. So she wrote something for me to read. So here it is. C. Anthony Martinetti was born into an Italian-American family in Boston, where he interned in the shops his father, uncles, and extended family owned and operated. At age 9, with his parents, 2 brothers and sister, moved to Lexington, where he still lives. After high school, Anthony spent some time in Canada, studying, working, doing theater. He completed his bachelor's degree in English at Holy Cross and earned a PhD in psychology from Boston University in 1995, with a dissertation on cults. I'll talk to you about that sometime. He has a private practice as a psychotherapist in Lexington, and he is a founding member of Sold Out Artists, that's S-O-U-L-E-D, Sold Out Artists, an eclectic group of writers, visual artists, and musicians who have met and performed regularly since 2009. Anthony's published 2 volumes of memoir short stories, Lunatic Heroes, mostly about his younger days, and Beloved Demons, which focuses on his adult years. Both volumes published by Swellis, is that it? Swellis Press? Were launched in the last year and a half, and both are heartfelt, a bit shocking and endearingly funny. So, Anthony, take it away.
Happy the Gloucester Writers Center asked me to come up. This is a really cool place, this church. This great stained glass above, it's beautiful. I'm very happy to be here. I'm very grateful to the 12 or so people I recognize out here who came all this way to see me. Peggy did something really difficult. She read excerpts from her novel. Sort of tough to do that, I think. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to read you a whole story. And I'm going to take a much longer time. So I hope you'll bear with me. And it's going to take me about 20 or 25 minutes to read the story. And I'm not really sure which one I'm going to read. I'm prepared to read a few. I don't know how many of you are familiar with my work, except for the people I know who came up to see me. I have a story called Swamp, which is from the first book, the Lunatic Heroes book. And that is about a relationship I had as a child with a bullfrog and the impact his life had on mine. And then from the second book, the one that just came out in December, I have another long story called Sign, which is about 45 years later, returning to the apartment I grew up in and what happened going there. So I've talked to my friends. I thought I'd ask you, do you want to hear a story about a bullfrog or about an apartment I went back to? Let me see your hands.
We can do both.
They're long stories. They're 20 to 25 minutes each. So I don't think I have an hour. And Peggy did a great job, and she only took up about 15 or 20 minutes. I feel like more narcissistic than I actually am. So would you like to hear a story about my relationship with the frog?
We want the frog.
Okay.
We're in a real big hurry.
They're complete stories. I can't do half a frog. It'd be like a dissection. Okay. This is entitled Swamp. Can you hear me okay? Okay. By the late 1950s, The oppression of Buddhists in Vietnam had become brutal. Meanwhile, in Lexington, I was just a boy and was concerned with other matters like bullfrog. The bullfrog in the swamp near my house was humongous. He was black, long-legged, and faster than imagination. I suppose we called it the swamp because it was a stagnant, scum-coated pool of water, even though it was only a bit larger than your ordinary suburban home footprint. Sparsely wooded land and rocks big enough to climb up on surrounded it. And there was plenty of scrub vegetation, and vines were hanging here and there. It lay in the middle of the next lot over, where one day a large house would stand. But from 1957, when I came across it, until 1963, it served as our rainforest, animal refuge, scenes for Black Lagoon monster fantasies, and the center of our wildlife experiences. In short, it was the other side of the world, 60 feet from the house. All of us neighborhood kids and our dogs went there alone and in packs to see salamanders, their clear ribbons of eggs, tadpoles, garter snakes, toads, snapping turtles, and the fish we referred to as carp. We'd go there to poke sticks, toss rocks, and especially to meditate on bullfrog. He was around every spring, bullfrog was, and all summer, and a good part of each fall, and legend held that in winter he'd retire to the mud on the swamp floor, where he'd suspend himself under the ice cover, growing larger in silent darkness, still impenetrable, employing the mad yogic skills that we'd heard about until March, just after the arrival of the brave crocuses, when he'd reappear to mystify and elude us again for another season. You could never get too near him. It was as if he had a scanner somewhere on the lot. He'd leap virtually before the first sound of a crackle footstep, and you'd hear the blop, sometimes followed by a parting and a closing of green slime. If you'd been there for a while, usually you'd see his entirety only in mid-flight, but you might catch a glimpse of his eyes piercing the surface. Then he would slip once again, inscrutably, beneath the murk. And you counted yourself lucky to have had such a vision. Now, I respected him in a strange way and was also a little afraid of him, something to do with the sensational chasm between us. He represented a tremendous mystery, and I was awed by the namelessness of what I sometimes felt. How did he actually live in the winter? Did he know me in some way? Was he aware of some individual impression of me as I was of him? Did he know things, deep and distant things, that only frogs but not humans could know? This, of course, was all quite impossible to decipher because he was essentially inscrutable. But at the time, it was all part of the meditation on bullfrog, which I regularly engaged. Though he was wholly and totally other, I felt connected to him, to say nothing of the fact that he lived next door. It was his spot, his place on the other side of the world, in what I had embraced as part of my world. And he kept it under his quiet control and discretion, living a silent and contemplative life shrouded in his damp and shadowy monastery. Conversations over those summers as we whiled away hours on the swamp's bank went often like this.
Hey, did you see bullfrog yet?
Nah, but almost.
Yeah, me too. Danny Tooden says he touched them yesterday.
What? He's lying.
Yeah, he's lying. And so on. Catching Bullfrog was a fantasy many of us had, the way catching a troll or a unicorn may have been for Summer, seeing Bigfoot or an alien or Loch Ness Monster was for others. I don't think I truly wanted to capture him. It was for me a magnificent dream that I wanted to remain a dream, the kind that if you wake from is gone, never to return in the same way. And I wanted to dream, to remain in my youthful, languid summer slumber. And I needed Bullfrog and the swamp to lay there with me, restful in contented lethargy. Inevitably, kids fell off the rocks and into the swamp at least a few times each summer. You couldn't really drown unless you were like 2 years old and panicked, forgetting that the water probably wasn't all the way over your head, except if you landed in the very middle, and what the heck were you doing there anyway? I'd seen four-year-olds extricate themselves from their impending watery graves through sheer determination and the power of their blood-curdling screams. And we'd always extend a stick or a belt to a little kid if he was standing there chest deep, coated with green scum and draped with salamander eggs, stuck in the mud, shaking and hollering that some unspecified entity has a hold of his leg or something. Those immersions were badges of merit and holy rites of passage. And you'd hear kids say, even years later, I fell in once. It was weird. The swamp was a sort of turned around fountain of youth. Once you went into it, you aged, or at least your soul got older. Perhaps it was a kind of baptism of fire reserved for us by Brother Bullfrog. One time, years later, Penny Russo fell through some of the snow-covered rocks that surrounded the swamp on a late December afternoon as the sky was darkening during a windless and heavy snowfall. I was in my driveway and thought I heard muffled cries beyond the snowbanks that framed our yard. As I approached the swamp, I saw the tips of trembling, frost-covered fingers poking up through the frozen crust in a gap between two huge rocks. Being much older than she was, I was able to pull her straight up and out by her wrists. She emerged, unexpectedly coatless, with her eyes popping out of her head, and the moment her toes hit the ground, she spun wordlessly and dashed across the street to her house, disappearing into the hush of thick snowflakes, crying, "Help, Mommy! Help, Mommy! I'm sorry!" These hysterics were in no small measure due to the fact that her mother was a colossal tyrant, a squint-eyed stick of a woman who was known in the neighborhood for the thrice-daily ringing of a large handheld brass bell used to summon her nervous Pavlovian offspring home. And God forbid if the dog got there before those kids did. We could only imagine the hell there was to pay. Mrs. Russo was known over the years for yelling at her children and husband, other neighbors, and each of us kids at one time or another for various infractions and infringements of which we had been entirely unaware prior to the ferocious bell-ringing accompanied reprimands we'd receive. It was an effective and disorienting method, I'll tell you, and we could only stand there dumb and deafened during the ceremonial and clamorous chastisement. My mother referred to her as that lady with that friggin' bell. Evidently, Penny, while trapped in the crevice, had been hearing the bell's repeated and increasingly vigorous ringing. And it was the first time in her 9 years she hadn't run full tilt to her house, she must have assumed that she was dying or dead, trapped there in some kind of gothic nightmare, 30 yards from her front door. Mrs. Russo might have heard her daughter's plaintive cries if she'd only laid off clanging that infernal thing. I didn't see Penny around again till spring when I witnessed her mother demonstrating bell-ringing techniques to her on the front steps so she could qualify to summon her brother Gary, often known to be at large himself, and who accounted for most of the neighborhood cacophony. I believe the ordeal had proven too much for Penny, and she'd taken to becoming a siren instead of an explorer, giving up her dream of a brave and adventurous life, putting it off for a while, or perhaps forever. Swamp experiences had a way of changing you. One summer afternoon, some big kids I didn't know, there were three of them, were at the swamp when I arrived, and they had just caught bullfrog. To me, it was as if they had discovered Atlantis. I clicked into overdrive. "Hey, that's the frog!" I said, astonished and practically disoriented. "No shit, Sherlock," one of the boys answered. "Wow! Can I see him?" "You got eyes. You can see him." He was not so dark after all, but a deep and vibrant green. With large teenage hands around his belly, he had stretched himself right out, and man, if he wasn't 18 inches long. I was already hypnotized when the boys began walking away from the swamp with him towards my house, which was odd to me because I didn't know them and doubted they even knew it was my yard they were walking into. I wondered why they'd be taking him anywhere. I couldn't fit the entire scene in my head. Bullfrog coming over to my place, visiting his neighbor, kind of. "Well, what you doing?" I asked, eager but somewhat agitated to be part of this momentous and auspicious occasion. "Just watch," one of them said authoritatively. They set Bullfrog down at the bottom edge of my front yard, and when I saw him there out of his place and against the green of the grass, he seemed to change, darker again, and now smaller and stone still, never attempting a getaway, not the slightest effort to spring into flight, as was his typical course of action. Perhaps, I imagined, he was employing his wintertime competencies, his yogic trance, remaining in deep reserve. Perhaps it was something else that kept him there. Maybe some of that deep and distant knowledge I suspected he possessed. Or possibly the same thing that held me there, as the boys hurriedly fumbled with their pockets. I could barely wrench my eyes from him and only briefly glanced in the direction of the three others before I knew what was happening. One of them had forced open Bullfrog's mouth and jammed in a firecracker. Bullfrog remained ever motionless, accepting, apparently peaceful. He might have been in shock, but he just stood there in a wide stance, looking stable and strong. Now, I was gripped with anxiety. My legs shook. I felt woozy, but I knew I had to act. "Hey!" I started to move forward. "Hey, what? What are you going to do?" I asked, stopped in my tracks. "What do you think, jerk-off?" "No, don't," I croaked. "Who is this fucking kid?" one of the others asked. "Never mind him," his friend said as they bent to their task. "Hey, wait," I blurted out impotently. "Shut up!" one shouted, and I did. And the match was lit and put to the wick. I didn't fly to pull it out. I didn't yell for my mother. I didn't shout for help. I didn't fight for what I knew was right. I didn't do anything. I stood by, mute, frozen, afraid, stupid. And it went off. And Bullfrog's head jerked up and then came back with stunning speed. His mouth blew wide open, but he remained still, his eyes fixed straight ahead. I didn't know if he was dead standing there. I didn't know what was happening to him or me. The sound of the blast was deafening. Bullfrog's mouth remained hanging open. The aftershock and shrieking and hoo-haws of the boys started coming in and hurt my head. I felt the sounds all through me now and thought I was going to fall right down there or throw up. I raced back to the swamp, disassociated, smashing blind through the brambles. I hid by the rocks on the other side of the swamp, choking back my shame and rage-filled tears, lying down on a low rock, holding my head. I saw my face reflected in the water darkly. Time passed, but to me it just hung there, not moving, not stopped, as I wildly thought about what I should have done. When I returned to my yard, there was no sign of the big kids or of Bullfrog. I frantically searched the spot on the grass and saw shreds of paper and a tiny impression where the detonation had occurred. I stumbled around, confused and queasy. I had no idea what to do or where they went. I wanted to believe that he was okay and had taken off, hiding himself in the bushes, waiting for his time to go home. But I felt a sinking and certain knowledge that they had carried his shocked and injured body away to do it again somewhere else in order to finalize the deed, to get what they wanted from him, his suffering and his life. If he wasn't dead yet, I knew that soon he would be. And I also knew that I had been awakened and the dream was over. No more youth, no more summer sleep. The bell had rung for me now, but this one did not call me home. And soon I would have no choice but to climb through the ropes and into the war. I was too ashamed to tell anyone, afraid they'd ask what I did and why I didn't. My head hung down inside me after that, near a heart which leaked and burned. I hid because I let them. I let them wake me. I let them take me. I handed myself over to them, and so I hid. And now, a half century later, I carry his weight and meditate on him still. His sacrifice and my lack of strength contributed to my fantasy of becoming an avenging angel, protecting the helpless, coming to the rescue of the disenfranchised, standing up against abuses of power. I tried to do these things, but not frequently and seldom well. In fact, most often I've had regrets about the parts I've played, overreacting unnecessarily and inappropriately, or when real action was called for, freezing. Never enough, not nearly enough to rinse the guilt from my hands. 5 years after Bullfrog's passing, a Buddhist monk self-immolated in Southeast Asia on June 11th, 1963, in a protest against the brutal oppression by the Catholic regime in power in Vietnam. The monk had prepared for months in meditation, and at a busy intersection, his fellow monks poured gasoline on him, and then he lit the match. It was an act of tremendous courage and a sign to the world that he and his brothers could withstand any pain for the sake of his people. It was the most powerful image I had ever seen, and it brought back the stalwart and resolute figure of Bullfrog, standing firm in the face of his oppressors, and it also recalled my passivity in the face of his courage. The New York Times reporter who was present at the Vietnam burning wrote, "I was to see that sight again, but once was enough. Flames were coming from a human being. His body was withering and shriveling up, his head blackening and charring. In the air was the smell of burning flesh. Human beings burn surprisingly quickly." Behind me, I could hear the sobbing of the Vietnamese who were now gathering. I was too shocked to cry, too confused to take notes or ask questions, too bewildered to even think. As he burned, he never moved a muscle. or uttered a sound. The story goes that even after the incident, though he was cremated in Buddhist tradition, his heart would still not burn and is therefore considered holy and has since been in the custody of the Reserve Bank of Vietnam. This was the strength and power Bullfrog demonstrated to me in my boyhood, the passion and empathy invoked in me by him and the monk was unforgettable, immeasurable, and bottomless. The monk who gave his life was a hero to me, as was Bullfrog before him. And so the swamp was irrevocably transformed for me on that, my 10th summer. But I continued to visit, sitting on the rocks at its edge for years after, staring at the water, seeing my changing face reflected back, as I did on that day when I first saw my shame and sorrow in the swamp's mirror. In speaking with my brother about those days, he said, "You know, a lot of the swamp still existed even after the McAllisters built their house on that lot. More than half of the swamp was still out in their backyard. And then they built their swimming pool and that killed the rest of it." A moment later, he said, "Hey, I wonder where it is, the swamp. Got to be under there somewhere, no?" "Yeah," I replied, "got to be." I did not mention that although the swamp itself is gone, I keep it with me, my piece of the other side of the world. Perhaps I hang on to it in the hopes that it will prevent my heart from burning up. And I've maintained my position on the rocks. The picture in the water continues to be my dark reflections, of which I seem tireless. But since that summer, in the swamp swims an image of Bullfrog, which from time to time extends into full view, breaking the still surface, disturbing the static reflection, contorting and twisting it until it becomes more real, more me. In memoriam, Bullfrog, summer 1958, Tik Kong Duck, summer 1963.